"How are you feeling right now?" the teacher asked. "Shy and a little nervous. Curious and a little excited." "Anxious, excited? You seem like a great teacher." "By the way," he said to the Hispanic girl who blurted this out, "I've heard great things about you as well." Had he really? I wondered. There was a pause. "I know I sound like a suck-up," she went on, and he stopped her. "How long have you been in class already? 20 minutes? Okay, I know you. I can read you already. I know you are not a suck-up." "I'm not," she said. That's the way English 10G began, with command, with candor, with embarrassment, and reassurance. We were to be introduced to the difficulties and ardors of literature. The class would be a cross between boot camp for readers and the ante room of paradise. Our teacher was a slender man in his late 30s, about 5 feet 10 inches, taut and trim in a pink long-sleeve shirt rolled up to his forearms, a brown vest, a dark gold tie. He had thinning brown hair, a short, pointed beard. Sean Leon smiled a great deal. His voice was dry, a little hard in tone, penetrating, and he said what he wanted to say without hesitation or false starts. The accent, however, was hard to place. He had been born in Northern Ireland, a member of the Catholic minority in the city of Derry. His father was an American, a Navy guy, his mother Irish, and the family had moved to Louisiana near New Orleans, where he grew up. But his accent was neutral, certainly not Irish, and I couldn't hear a trace of the American South in it. Mr. Leon asked the students about their passions. Some played the guitar, some did photography, some played baseball or basketball, some were obsessed with family and friends. "I'm also passionate about my family," he said. "I'm passionate about teaching. I love what I do. When I come in, I will never not be here. I will bring it every day. I want to laugh because I laugh a lot, and I'm a cheese ball. I've been a cheese ball my entire life. I don't take myself too seriously. I take what I do very seriously." Suddenly, he darted to an empty chair and sprawled, legs apart. "Whatever," he said in mock boredom. He addressed us from the chair. "There are times when you're here physically, but you're not really here. You're in la-la land. You think you'd rather be somewhere else. I find that disgusting. I will be here every day. I'll stay in this building until 7 if I have to. I will never fail you. I will set the bar high, very high. Anything else just wouldn't do. By the way, I don't favor students who just play for the grade, for the A." They were silent. Some of them, I imagined, wouldn't mind knowing how to play for an A. He told them what would be expected of them. There would be quizzes on the reading and essays in class. They would keep journals, noting their responses to what they were reading, and they would hand in those journals every week. When he gave them printed versions of stories, he wanted them to take notes right on the printout, and he would read those notes when the students handed the stories back. The school would give them copies of the novels they were reading. They would attach post-its to the pages with their questions and responses. Again, when they handed the books back, he would read the post-its. They would be free to say whatever they wanted, but they would be monitored, at liberty, but judged. When it came time to write papers, he told them, they would first do an outline and then go through multiple drafts, handing in each draft before the final one. Writing, writing, writing. There would be no end to the writing. And talking, too. They would stand on their feet and make presentations in class. Class participation would be graded, but he warned them against their raising their hand merely to talk. "How many of you have been in a class in which people simply say the same thing as other people? Cat B says the same as Cat A. If that's your MO, it's a problem. Add something. Disagree." "Plagiarism is academic suicide," he suddenly announced with a mournful look, as if he had smelled a dead cat. "And then what was the theme of last year's reading in ninth grade? Self-discovery? This year, it's individual and society." So what happens when a leading journalist comes to visit, to literally sit in on, New York City high school classrooms where everyday teenagers are immersed in the study of great literature? Yep, that's the theme of the New Yorker's journalist and best-selling author David Denby's newest book, Lit Up. One reporter, three schools, 24 books that can change lives. This is real life, not some romantic or tragic Hollywood novel. Sparks fly, egos are slowly unwrapped, teenage emotions slip out into view. Lit Up is a fun and enlightening and sometimes enraging read. This is to say, a book that gives teachers and teenage students their due. Lit Up, conceived and written by Denby, takes us into three classrooms, led by some hard-hitting and literature-loving teachers. We just met one in that introduction. Teachers who respect their students enough to demand their high school students read long and serious books. Teachers who ask questions that get students to see themselves and their lives in these works of literature. Teachers who spur their students to learn by doing, by learning that reading can be fun because it gives so much more depth to their lives than their everyday social media can. And what books are they reading? Well, here are a few of those titles. Khalid Hosseini's The Kite Runner, William Faulkner's A Rose for Emily, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Sylvia Plath, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, George Orwell, Paul Coelho, Hermann Hesse, Kurt Vonnegut, Viktor Frankl, Fyodor Dostoevsky, Jean-Paul Sartre, Samuel Beckett, Sandra Cisneros, Harper Lee, William Shakespeare, Ernest Hemingway. And that's just 10th grade. Yes, as a child of the television era with all of its critics, I felt a pang of nostalgia and sometimes growled in displeasure as I was exposed to Denby's too often railing against the surface skating horrors of immersing oneself too often into that shallow intellectual pond that is the internet. When I was growing up, it was TV. I'm not sure how well this particular part of the book is going to stand the test of time, but still. For after all, Denby is a writer who is willing to criticize people, willing to criticize situations and ideas he finds to be worth writing about in the first place. Allow me to reference his early book, Great Books, My Adventures with Homer, Rousseau, Wolfe, and other indestructible writers of the Western world as an example of Denby's critical work. And let me note also that Denby says this about his own reading pleasures. As he writes, "I will indulge a resounding tautology. Every great civilization, including ours, has had a great literature and great readers. Speaking for myself, my life would be poorer, weaker, duller, without Jane Austen, Walt Whitman, Ralph Ellison, Saul Bellow, Raymond Chandler, John Le Carré, Zadie Smith, without John Grisham and Stephen King, too. Together and alone, we need literature as the California valleys need rain." He goes on to write, "Electronic utopians say, calm down, nothing has been lost. If anything, the opportunities for reading have become much greater. Plenty of books are being sold, and even if books as physical objects are doomed, reading will survive, even expand. After all, you can get anything." In the literal sense, he continues, this is true. You can find almost any book you want somewhere. Those who know what they are looking for can find it on a computer, a Kindle, a Nook, an iPad, a tablet, or a smartphone. The electronic library goes on forever, and the volumes will not get moldy. What technological utopians don't and can't explain, however, is this. How does the appetite for serious reading get created in the first place? A baby held in happy attention to books and stories has a good chance of loving reading as an adult. What about the others? Well, which prompts the question, what about Lit Up? Does our author David Denby succeed in convincing us that he's onto something real here, that there are teachers and students we ought to care enough about to keep reading to the book's conclusion? Does Lit Up give us hope in the future of humankind by showcasing the curiosity and the willingness to think by teenagers today? Well, yes, it does. Does Lit Up show us that teenagers in 2016 are as curious, as hormone-driven, as interested in being led to question themselves and society as they have ever been? Yes. So yes, this book is accurately titled. Lit Up is a play on the power of literature to excite us at any age, really, and the ability of literature to play with themes and ideas that may be old in terms of when they were written, but up to date in the themes, the characters, the situations that live on and on in life long after those pages were written. As he writes near the end of the book, "If teachers initially accommodate student interests and emotions, the ambitious ones move them up and out. For instance, the dark side runs right through pop culture, a spectacle as wondrous, the thrill of the forbidden. In evil, there is vitality, or at least gaudy self-assurance, and American teenagers know that and wonder over it. Instead of fighting their absorption, our teachers nurtured and deepened student fascination by turning it toward art. They assigned fictions and memoirs chronicling extreme experience, the loss of identity, the exhilarations and tragedies of living out at the edge. They gently broke down protective narcissism, launching the students into the grown-up world of moral difficulty, contingency, money, family, love, loss, and death. They did not emphasize craft, technique, and historical circumstances in which the books were composed, and that was for later. Instead, they wanted students to have an actual experience when they read. And the students, for the most part, were not offended by work that was hard for them. On the contrary, they were flattered. Curious and ambitious teenagers always read things that are too hard for them and fail to understand half of what they read. But frustration only makes them eager to find out more. The acceptance of initial failure is built into avid natures. Ordinary kids may also feel haunted by what they don't quite understand, haunted if it moves them in some way. Even in a classroom assignment, they don't have to understand everything in a book in order to be excited by it, awed by it. They will enjoy the ego boost of having read something difficult. Overmastered at first, they will move toward mastery of themselves. If you've not met him through his film reviews in the New Yorker magazine or his full-length books previously published, let me introduce you to David Denby, a journalist who knows how to paint a picture in words, how to get his reader, us, to turn a page, how to invest us in the story we're reading because he is so invested in the story. In his bibliography, and yes, I kind of glanced through the bibliography, he tells us he had to do more research because he was curious. And so we become curious, too. The real-life characters we meet in these pages, from the teachers to the students to, yes, David Denby, our narrator-presenter, are people I wanted to learn more about. And so I kept reading. As another reviewer of Lit Up presents it, quote, "If reading about sitting in on a 10th grade English class sounds dull, it isn't. The students, with their touching blend of toughness and vulnerability, are far more sympathetic than I, or I think Denby, expected. And the amazing devotion of Denby's chosen English teachers to their students is awe-inspiring." End quote. One final note. Lit Up is a book about challenges and ideas that provoke emotional discussion at online review sites. I'll posit that not a little of this arguing comes from the well-worn prejudices we all have, be those our own prejudgments, positive, negative, agnostic, towards what is a classic of literature and what about teenagers who are reading. Most of all, David Denby is a persuasive writer to those of us willing to engage with him with his ideas. He wants us to come along with him as he tells us the stories of these teachers, these students, the stories they wrestle with in the classics. Anecdotes, grand ideas, they're all here to keep us enthralled and turning these pages. As he concludes in his own words, "Teenagers, distracted, busy, self-obsessed, are not easy to engage, not by their teachers or by their parents. To keep them in the game, the teachers I watched experimented, altered the routine, changing the physical dimensions of the class. They kept the kids off balance in order to put them back in balance. They demanded more of the students than the students expected to give. They talked candidly, acknowledging that they were neither perfect nor invulnerable. They were more experienced, certainly, than students. They were guides, leaders, dispensers of knowledge and justice, but also people subject to the ups and downs, the happiness and mishaps that the students were subject to. They demonstrated that it was possible to do without losing, they demonstrated that it was possible to do that without losing authority. In fact, in media-sozzled America, where skepticism is the prevailing mode of thought, candor may be the way of gaining authority. Teaching is about building trust. Acknowledgement of one's own humanity is one powerful way of building it. As I knew at the beginning of my reporting and reading, there is no perfect syllabus, no perfect set of classroom conversations, and certainly no perfect model for how understanding, assurance, and daring should be enlarged in teenagers. Intellectual ability and emotional intelligence are built through an innumerable number of small steps. If we think of our own lives, we will remember how gradually, through oh so many moments, through so many stupidities, errors, evasions, seeming failures, we moved ahead and got any place worth going to. Education is laborious and intermittent. Strength may come in sleep and dreams and fantasy. But after children leave their parents' arms, school is still the necessary place for knowledge and soul to spring into life. And good teachers are still the loving instigators of that miracle. David Denby lit up. One reporter, three schools, 24 books that can change lives. It's quite a read. It's available at all of our fine local libraries, including the West Lafayette Public Library.